Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. It's very nice to have you with us. It is Monday, and it is the, let me check my watch real quick. It's the 27th of March, and it's 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. We wish you a very, very beautiful Monday morning and hope you are enjoying it to the fullest. We have a great panel. We have a lot to talk about, and we have a lot to do this morning, so we'll get to it and start. A reminder that if you would like to be a part of the program and you would like to write to us and have a say in some of the issues that we talk about, all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we would love to hear from you. Alan Chartok, good morning. How are you, sir?
Cool. I'm cool.
Excellent. Good to hear it. Have a nice weekend. Everything good?
Yeah. Everything was nice. You know, you walk a little, you think a little, you look up at the sky. It's all nice.
Look a little, think a little.
Look up at the sky. Yeah, that's a great song.
It is, yeah.
Just pick a little tune.
Yeah. It's a little... I'm Music Man. A little Music Man.
Yeah.
Like talk a little, pick a little, talk a little, pick
yeah.
a little.
Yeah,
that's what I was
thinking.
Okay. Look, Sarah Rogerson is here, Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center and director of the Immigration and Law Clinic. Sarah Rogerson, good morning.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you with us. We also welcome UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Very nice to have you with us. And our old pal Libby Post joins us, political consultant.
Hello.
And hello.
Oh, hello.
Libby Post with us. And Libby, it's a delight as always to have you here. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Nice to
very
have you
much.
Here. All right. Let's see. We have stuff to talk about. We'll get to it. And again, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Oh, someone is official.
Yes.
Okay, somebody is now online. Let's talk about Israel and the headline in the New York Times this morning. Israel boils as Netanyahu ousts minister who bucked court overhaul. We will explain. Civil unrest broke out in parts of Israel Sunday night after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu fired his defense minister for criticizing the government's divisive judicial overhaul, prompting protesters to surge into the streets, universities to shut their doors, and union leaders to hint of a looming general strike. I would gently recommend that if you have not seen the pictures of the people in the streets and the protests that are taking place. If you think you've seen pictures of protests, you got to see what's going on there. And it's really, it's troubling, obviously, but it's also fascinating to see that many people. Announced in a one-line statement by the Prime Minister's office, the dismissal intensified an already dramatic domestic crisis, one of the gravest in Israeli history, set off by the government's attempts to give itself greater control over the selection of Supreme Court justices and to limit the court's authority over parliament. The dismissal unleashed chaotic late-night demonstrations in and around Tel Aviv, where protesters blocked a multi-lane highway, set fires in at least two major roadways, and in Jerusalem, where crowds broke through police barriers outside Mr. Netanyahu's private residence. As midnight approached, it also prompted the heads of Israel's leading research universities to collectively announce that they were closing their classrooms for the immediate future. Israel's consul general in New York to resign, and the country's largest workers' union to warn that it may announce a general strike today in conjunction with leading businesses. So a lot going on. This crisis over the future of Israel's judiciary had already spurred weeks of protest, tensions with the Biden administration and unrest in the military. Now it has caused a rift in the governing coalition itself, unusual political coordination from senior academics, and rare political intervention from trade unionists. A lot there. Would you like to begin, Libby?
Sure. Netanyahu is a fascist. Plain and simple. He is a threat to the existence of Israel. And I'm sure there are going to be some people who agree with me and some people who don't. But this is not what a democracy is. This is not what the people, even the people on the right, because he's gotten pushback from some of his own coalition members, voted for. This idea that, oh, we're doing this to make sure that there's more diversity in the judiciary and that they deal with all the various issues of the various people that are in Israel, as well as the Palestinians and in the West Bank and Gaza, is such a joke, because the last people they want to make sure has any rights within the borders of pre-67 and post-67 are the Palestinians and then the Arab Israelis. I mean, look, everyone knows I'm Jewish. This isn't a surprise. Everybody knows I support Israel's right to exist. That's not a surprise either. But what he is doing is an existential threat to the democracy within Israel, the only democracy in the area. Let's not forget that. Okay. And this undergirds because I've had conversations with people about this who know a lot more about it than I do, but this really undergirds the way Israel was established. It wasn't about democracy, it was about survival. And so, yes, they put in a parliamentary form of government, and they said that they were a democracy, and they have been acting that way for a very long time until now. And Netanyahu needs to watch what's happening here in the United States. Trump has his loyalists. Netanyahu has his loyalists. But it's the people in the middle and to the left that are going to be the undoing of both of them. And he, you know, when he was reelected, I was really disappointed because of who elected him and why. And the other part of this is this.
Yes.
The military. The military is saying no to this. And the people who got him elected, the far right, the Haredi, the far ultra-Orthodox, do not serve. And the people in the military know it. And that's part of this as well.
You mean don't serve in the military?
They don't serve in the military. They don't do anything. They live off the dole and study Torah all day long and insert themselves in politics in a way that they shouldn't insert themselves, like the radical Christian right does in this country.
I guess I have a chicken and egg question.
Oh, yeah.
For you
it's
or
an omelet.
Or for Alan, but you look at Netanyahu as a leader, and his current leadership was very fragile.
Yeah.
I mean, was leader, got bounced, came back by a whisker.
Right.
Had to make up this coalition, had a lot of problems doing that. So how much of that is a result of that never being fully resolved?
Well, one would think that winning by a hair's breadth, he would be a little more reluctant to be as totalitarian and autocratic as he is.
You don't govern like you have a mandate.
That's right. You don't. Yeah. And he didn't have a mandate, but he is looking at other authoritarian leaders. He's looking at the guy in Turkey, Erdogan,
mm-hmm.
right? And Bolsonaro, I think was his name, mm-hmm. in Brazil. He got bounced out. But he's looking at these other authoritarian leaders. He's looking at, I hate to say it, he's looking at the Shahs and the Sheikhs all over the Middle East and saying, why can't I be like that? Why can't I be omnipotent and nobody question me? This notion that we have to protect the Jewish state at all costs is going to cost the Jewish state. So that's what it's going to do.
Alan.
Well, I'm interested in what Libby just said, that it's going to cost the Jewish state. I'd like just a little bit more, Lib, if we can, about how it's going to cost.
Well, I think you're going to see the natural allies, the people who have, the countries that have been aligned with Israel, who value the fact that it was the a democracy within a sea of non-democratic countries, like the United States, they're not happy, like France, like Germany, like England, like Canada, like the, you know, the G8. You know, or now it's a G7 because Russia's not going to come to their aid. Although you never know. I mean, the next thing I expect is to see Netanyahu go have lunch with Putin because they're, you know, definitely down the same pathway. But, you know, it's going to cost. And so whether or not the United States totally cuts off its aid, which is big, to Israel, I doubt because in the long run,
bad politics.
Right. It's bad politics. And also, we need to make sure that our presence is in the Middle East in a country that wants us there. But, you know, what's going to happen with other leaders remains to be seen. And I just think that they are playing with... They're playing Russian roulette with the country.
Alan?
Well, I think a lot has been said already. We're going to have to see how it plays out, and we don't know how it will play out. We don't know who's going to be where. Yeah. It's going to be very convoluted.
Well, you have dramatic and beautiful protests. Israeli Philharmonic is taken to the streets.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what a democracy is, how a democracy, the people that populate a democracy are supposed to react in the face of potential theocracy. I'm not Jewish, so I consult with my friend Rabbi Matt Cutler in Gates of Heaven, and I ask him, you know, what's the threat here? And he said it's a huge threat to secularism and women's rights and individual choice
and LGBT rights. Mm-hmm. You know, they are starting to really look at cracking down, and Israel was one of the bright spots always. Around this, not necessarily in Jerusalem, but in Tel Aviv. There's always been a thriving gay community in Tel Aviv. And yeah, it's a theocracy because you're going to have, what's so interesting is you're going to have people who didn't believe in the establishment of the country in 1948 because God hadn't been there yet to give it to us, and there hadn't been that whole thing that was supposed to happen in order for Israel to really be established from a religious point of view. And they're the ones calling the shots now. They're the ones. They recognize that, here's a political power base that we can have. And they are reproducing at massive rates. And I'm talking about having kids. And, you know, replenishing that voter base over and over again. And you know, it's like they took a page out of the radical Christian rights playbook here in the United States.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, that what struck me so much about this story is the how it mirrors so much of what's happening here in the United States. Mm. And also, you know, what's really prompted this change in the judiciary the proposal to do that is Netanyahu is facing upcoming, I mean, pretty near corruption charges and litigation.
Again.
Right.
It's going on forever.
It has, but, you
sort
know.
Sort of like someone else we know.
Well, that's, you know, it's sort of a rising problem in around the globe, right? And for the United States to also be an example of that. I don't think that my other point is I don't think that media coverage has really been where it should be about this story over the weekend. We have spent a lot of time in the United States talking about all these possibilities and hypotheticals with Donald Trump rather than really paying attention to how democracies are struggling internationally and how similar the problems rising toward authoritarianism is in other places.
We have to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Sarah Rogerson, and Libby Post, we welcome your input as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back after these messages in BBC News. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. We have a lot of letters on Israel, which is the subject we started off with this morning. And does anybody have anything else to say prior to? Have you feel like you've said enough?
I'm perched. Libby?
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Then we'll go to the letters. Netanyahu does not equal Trump, says Mark. Netanyahu does not equal Putin, says Mark. It is so irresponsible for anyone on your panel to imply such a thing. Israel's survival depends upon strong leaders. Netanyahu may have his faults, and he may even have done some wrong things. But please, don't try to equate him to those other monsters. He is a large reason why Israel has survived. So my question to Mark would be, which he can't answer because he's not on the radio, but I will have maybe you try to think of what that means. But if you align yourself with Trump, if you align yourself with Putin, as Netanyahu has done, how does that not put him into the same basket?
Don't ask me. I don't know. I think he is in the same basket, and there are plenty of Jews in this country who think the same way. And, you know, it's what he has done, this notion of taking over the judiciary flies in the face of democratic principles. Mm-hmm. It's just that simple. I mean, look what we're doing here in this country. When Trump did what he did in the Supreme Court, we all went nuts. We all pushed back. And then we saw what they did, and the 2022 elections was a result of what of the Supreme Court's actions on choice. There's no two ways about it. And so, you know, people need to understand that there are three branches of a democratic government: executive, judiciary, legislative. They work separately. They work, and especially the judiciary must be separate from government interference, because they need to, and political interference, because they need to interpret the law of the land. And what we're seeing in the United States is a judiciary, a Supreme Court now, that was totally influenced by politics.
Yeah.
And people were brought on specifically to overturn Roe v. Wade. And now they're going to overturn affirmative action. I don't think they'll overturn marriage equality, because I just think it'll be too much of a morass with the IRS, although they don't care if the IRS really exists. So, you know, I mean, they're overturning 50 to 75 years of precedent. It started when the former court, which still had a good conservative bent to it, not overturned, but threw out parts of the Voting Rights Act, I think is the best way to put it, and said, oh, we don't need that anymore. Everybody has the right to vote. And we have seen what's happened with that, where states across this country are engaging in legislative voter suppression.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, I think that when we're considering Netanyahu and that people get drunk off their own power.
Yep.
And just because maybe they have done some good things in the past that were progressive or helped defend, we'll say, the right cause at that time, doesn't mean that later on they may not be looking out for their own interests rather than the moral and ethical right thing to do. And in this case, when you see how the protesters are from all different sectors and very serious sectors in a united effort, it's not just one group like the military or one group. You know, this is unprecedented in a sense that you have the universities, you have military, you have workers and companies supporting that union effort, right? That lets you know that there is something else happening here. It's not that he should be defended perhaps by everyone, as if because he did good things in the past, he should just be followed now and nobody should criticize him. Clearly, he's moving in a way that's out of step with the majority of the people.
Let's go to some other letters here. We have many, so I'll get to many as I can before our break. Difficult to hear Israel referred to as a democracy over and over again this morning when it has been illegally occupying Palestinian territories for decades. Please clarify and explain that these protests are about the erosion of democracy for Jews in Israel only. Palestinians have never experienced Israeli democracy.
No, she's absolutely right. Or he's absolutely right.
Yes. All right.
And I just note that the United States is a democracy and is just as guilty of the similar
stuff. Right.
Different geography.
Right.
Different geopolitical landscape.
Right. Mm-hmm. I know that it was a long time ago, but in 1967, you know, Israel was attacked and they overcame their attackers and took the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And so it was a spoil of war. Whether they should have stayed there or not is, you know, a geopolitical question that's a little bit above my pay grade. But I know the reasoning was we need to protect ourselves because all of our neighbors want to drive us into the sea. So what do you do when you're in that situation? You know, you keep the land. Could they have treated the Palestinians better and integrated them more into Israeli society? Absolutely. Would it have been better for Israel? Yes, because they wouldn't be facing that political issue as well as now these other political issues.
Ken writes to us and says, I had begun to lose hope that Israel had any decency left in it and that it had been lost to fascist ideology. As Libby stated, Netanyahu is a right-wing dictator and is completely absorbed in burying his crimes of corruption. These massive popular protests give me heart that there is a soul in Israel. It's time to take back the political power from the fundamentalist lunatics. That from Ken this morning. We go to this letter from Ed. Libby is correct. Want me to stop there?
Yeah, that's
okay,
great.
All right. They may not have an absolute voting majority, but those who actually run, protect, and allow Israel to function daily have the ability to shut Israel down. The right wing and religious extremists will not be able to succeed. That from Ed. Then Jose checks in and says, we're seeing in Jerusalem what one hopes would happen in Washington if one of our own fascist leaders, of which we have plenty, were to return to power or assume power anew. Seeing what's happening in Israel is heartening and frightening all at once. Then we go to this letter from Joel. Netanyahu is a fascist and a criminal just like Trump. The fired defense minister should lead a military coup, arrest Netanyahu, and call for elections in 90 days. So that brings me to the point of where I wanted to get to, which is what the panel thinks as to the survival of Netanyahu through this and what it's going to be like over the next several days, weeks, and months for his time as president.
I'll leave it up to you guys. I've been talking a lot.
I mean, if the playbook holds true, it really depends on who has the most power in the pushback. If it's the military, if it's the academy, it rarely is. Usually it's so they can throw the lawyers and the professors in jail. And it really depends on how forcefully he insists on what he's doing. I think, you know, my armchair quarterback assessment of these as somebody who just follows the news is that if Parliament really, really self-organizes and pushes back, he's going to have to walk some things back. But there's a lot at play. It will be fascinating to see which group emerges or groups. The fact that it's interdisciplinary, across all different sectors of society, including, you know, I think I said this during the break, but the rabbinical rabbinical pushback is a big deal. Like when you see.
Yes, but the thing is this. The rabbinical pushback in the United States is a big deal. In Israel, the Orthodox run the show rabbinically. Rabbis like, from my movement, the conservative movement, are continually marginalized. It's called the Masorti movement. They're marginalized. And Reform rabbis, while they I know some folks who have gone over for Aliyah and are living there now, from I think from what I understand of it, from a being able to practice point of view, they're even further marginalized. So it's going to mean it's going to take the American Jewish community. It's going to take AIPAC to get off of its butt and do the right thing. It's going to take J Street, which has always been doing the right thing, and other organizations to really push back. And the money has to stop. That's part of the issue. AIPAC sends a lot of money, as well as gives a lot of money here to the Congress people and senators who support Netanyahu and support the president administration. So, you know, that's the religious thing. It's got to come from the United States.
Well, I also wonder then if this is going to result in some travel restrictions, given the growing opposition in the country. Yep. They don't need thousands more progressives joining from the United States.
Right. Look, it's, you know, I hate to put it this way, but if I was to go to do a conversion, an Orthodox conversion in Israel, I would not be granted it because I'm a lesbian. Right. Lynn would not be granted, but I'm a Jew and they can't really do anything about that. Lynn would not be seen as a Jew. She converted because it was a conservative conversion. It wasn't an Orthodox conversion. So they're saying who's a Jew and who's not now. And, you know, it's like, it's not easy to convert. It's 2 years of study and a lot of other stuff. And so it's like, come on. You know, you want to turn away people who are potentially going to support you if your politics are better, if you are more receptive to who's a Jew and who's not a Jew. I mean,
so I would suspect that the financial powers at play have more sway over Netanyahu than Jewish identity.
Oh, well, probably. Well, you know, it'll be interesting to see where his money comes from now, if we could see it.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Great group this morning. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Sarah Rogerson, Libby Post. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Listening to the Manhattan Transfer this morning, their
terrific
50th anniversary,
yeah,
and final world
love
tour
them,
with special guest Laurel Massé at the Egg in Albany on Wednesday night. You can find out information by going to theegg.org, theegg.org. The Manhattan Transfer will be playing their music throughout the panel this morning. All right, let's go to other things here. We'll talk about other subjects. And we welcome your letters as always. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We had this on the docket on Friday. We did not get to it, and I'm glad actually that we have Sarah here today that we can talk a little bit about this. U.S. and Canada have reached an agreement on diverting asylum seekers. The deal reached just before President Biden arrived in Canada for an official trip allows both countries to reduce a surge in migration. The United States and Canada have reached the agreement that will allow both countries to divert the asylum seekers from their borders at a time when migration has surged. The deal, which is set, was announced on Friday by President Biden and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau after the two leaders met in Ottawa to allow Canada to turn back immigrants at Roxham Road, a popular unofficial crossing point from New York for migrants seeking asylum in Canada. In exchange, Canada has agreed to provide a new legal refugee program for 1,500 migrants who are fleeing violence, persecution, and economic devastation in South and Central America, lessening the pressure of illegal crossings into the United States and Mexico. Sarah.
I think it was 15,000 for the new program in Canada.
Legal refugee program for 15,000 migrants who are fleeing violence, persecution, and economic devastation.
Right. And that's significant. This is devastating and ridiculous and political theater of the worst kind. All the articles that I'm reading, the quotes from Canadian representatives who have to be so diplomatic, they're basically saying, we're trying to the opinion of the general public in terms of favorability for migration is in decline, and we, in order to change that, we have to look like we're doing something to curb it in order for people to feel comfortable with migration again, which there's a lot of social psychology to unpack there, and that's not my field, but I don't think it's a responsible justification for violating the international laws of non-refoulement, essentially, which is a fancy word for sending people back to places where they'll be killed or can't survive. It's striking how quickly this went into effect, within hours. It's comparable to the Muslim ban in terms of expediency. Before people start writing letters, it is not at all like the Muslim ban in terms of, you know, what it actually says or does. But I don't see the United States lifting the refugee cap, which has been at a historic low for eons. In the reports I've read, Canadian officials are also talking out of both sides of their mouths the way that we do in North America about migration, saying that Canada's success relies on migration, just like U.S. success relies on migration. I was just at the Rockefeller Institute with our esteemed mayor here in Albany, Kathy Sheehan, who highlighted information from the National Conference of Mayors that lays out clearly that the United States is losing more people from the workforce than it can replace in the number of millions, tens of millions of people. And we are going to need to radically alter our approach to immigration. And there are easy ways under the law currently to do this, which is, you know, providing people with humanitarian forms of relief that give them permission to work, right? That's an automatic infusion of people into the workforce. She reports that businesses are asking her to bring in people who would be willing to work if they could do so lawfully. And so it's just mind-bending. I know, Alan, I was thinking that I was worrying about a question from Alan this morning about polls and people's popular opinion about migration. And I have to say that when we look to leaders for normative stances, this is the opposite direction if you want more positive or favorable public opinion around migration. Because if the government starts to look like it's unfavorable to migration, you end up with a drop in popularity numbers. And I mean, that's what the Trump administration was brilliant at doing. Mm-hmm. Systemically, Stephen Miller, the architect in the White House of some of the most oppressive immigration policies we've had in recent history. And here we are. So, you know, favorability numbers are declining. Governments feel like they have to do something to win elections. And we end up, as Canada and the United States, stable democracies with stable economies who need migrants to function, enacting more restrictionist policies very quickly in order to handle a short-term problem.
So what do you think is going to happen now?
People are going to get turned away. they're going to die. The end. That's how it works. People don't want to face that reality. They want to think, oh, it's, you know, surely they'll find a way to survive. It's just not true. That doesn't happen. And not only that, but when you talk about climate change and how people are going to have to move anyway, like, it is unprecedented, the global number of folks who are moving. It's going to be us. Some of us in the United States, when I say us, I mean United States, people who have United States citizenship, why don't I say it that way? People who have a claim to be here as citizens, bestowed by the government or birthright, which still exists, even though Trump tried to undo that too. So where are we going to go? And we're basically putting together the rules for where we can and can't go. All these folks who were like, oh, if America gets unsafe, I'm going to go to Canada. Well, no, you can't. Too bad. Good luck. Stay here. Suffer with us. That's the way it goes. We are going to feel more directly the consequences of our own immigration policies when the climate forces us to face the same barriers that we're putting in people's way.
What do we know about the history of Canada and especially the of Trudeau on this issue over the last several years and more globally over the last few decades?
Canada has had a more generous humanitarian refugee system that's worked pretty well for them. Their political problem is that because of that, and because of the United States going in the opposite direction, they're seeing more people try to get to Canada through the United States because you have to go through the United States to get to Canada if you're going on foot or if you arrive in the United States first. So this is a pivot away from more expansive, generous humanitarian welcome and toward soft restriction, right? They're just saying, well, if you can get asylum in another country, but we did this under the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. They did this for the Northern Triangle countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and it was laughable because it was like, okay, sure, you could seek asylum in some of these countries. They have two judges for the whole country to process hundreds, thousands of claims. Like, that's not going to work, right? And then you have these, so then you have government manufactured crises. So we'll see that reproduce itself. It's just that people who don't know about the Safe Third Country Agreement and somehow end up in the United States on their journey to Canada are going to be stuck here and stuck to face our restrictionist immigration regime, which, by the way, includes not having a guaranteed counsel for deportation proceedings, which means you could get evicted from the United States, physically removed without having a lawyer represent you. Kids as young as 3 and 4 have had to represent themselves against adult government attorneys in immigration court. So that's what we're looking at. Canada has a different system. I've written comparative articles on it. I think, you know, bottom line is they have traditionally and historically been more receptive, particularly for folks who are fleeing harm.
All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters on this. We'll move on to other subjects as well. We welcome your voices, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Sarah Rogerson, and Libby Post making up the panel. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We love having you with us. So a couple of things that I want to tell you about. First of all, there is going to be an event tomorrow night which is at SUNY Albany, and it is at the Campus Center Ballroom, and it's called Highlighting Black Women, Engagement in Our Democracy and Society. And Jennifer, you will be hosting that event. Hazel Dukes and C.G. Dodds will be the panel.
Oh, great.
C.G. used to be on our panel. Mm-hmm. We're very excited. Mm-hmm. So tell us of what will be going on.
So this is the Africana Studies Department at SUNY Albany co-sponsored this event. It is the third meeting of the New York State Commission on African American History. That commission was signed into law by executive order by Kathy Hochul to look into the long history that has been omitted of African Americans in general in New York State, so that our state can understand better the research that's being done or the lack of it on African American history. And can look into how to continue to diversify our education system and our just general knowledge of African Americans in the state of New York. The meeting is going to be from 5:30 to 7:30. It will have the panel discussion prior to the meeting starting at 5:30. So from 4 to 5:30, I've arranged for local institutions in our area to come and exhibit items from their collections and to discuss with the public, whoever would like to come, it's free and open to the public, to see the research that has been conducted, to hear about the ideas and the projects that they can become involved in the future in Rensselaer County, Schenectady County, and Albany County, to gather and collect the stories of African Americans in the state, and also to start to let the governor and the legislature really know how much has been omitted and how much really still needs to be unearthed and written about and researched in the state.
It's UAlbany's Africana Studies event to highlight Black women in New York State history, running tomorrow 5:30 to 7:30 with the exhibits prior to that, March 28th. There is a really long address to RSVP, but if you go to albany.edu, you can find it and just put in Africana Studies event and it'll come up. But just to be completist, if you write this down, rsvp-nyscaah@dos.ny.gov.
Yes.
We'll have that on our site.
Very good.
I love that. Show. Thank you very much.
rsvp-nyscaah@dos.ny.gov. That is a wonderful program. Best of luck with
it. I am
congratulations
so
for putting
excited.
It together. Excellent. Also, wanted to just mention real quick that for Rosemary Armeo fans, Rosemary and I will be in discussion tonight at MPAC, the MPAC Theater. We're discussing understanding media in complex times.
I saw that.
I thought,
this is going to be fun.
Yeah. Well, come on over. Join us for a thought-provoking conversation with myself and Rosemary, and we should have a lot of fun. It's at MPAC.
What time?
7 o'clock. March 21st at 7 o'clock.
March 27th.
March 27th is what I meant. Thank you very much. And it's, I believe it is mpac.rpi.edu to find out more information. mpac.rpi.edu. Real quick, back to Jennifer's event. You also, we are not doing this tonight, but you will also have a live stream of that event.
Yes. For the 5:30 to 7:30 meeting, there will be a live stream, but I'm pushing the public to remember that 4 to 5:30, they can come and they can go through the exhibits, these seven local institutions, and see what is there, and then attend from 5:30 to 7:30 the meeting.
It'll be great. It's so much fun to be there, and we'll do our event tonight. We'll talk. We'll have a Q&A. I did an event yesterday, and during the Q&A, I fell off the riser.
Oh no.
Did you hurt your knee?
Yes.
What did you do?
It was bad.
It was painful. Did you hit it straight on?
It was bad. Yeah, it was bad.
Oh,
it was, but you know what? We were almost done. We only had like 15 minutes. And once I figured out how to sort of maneuver myself behind like this planter where you wouldn't see that my pants were bloodied, I thought, well, that's good, you know. But
how
anyway.
How are you now?
What?
How are you doing now?
I'm fine. You know, you have a lot of Advil, a lot of Aleve, and tonight I'll just sit down and do the Q&A.
Thank
you. It's not the blood. It's the did it impact the injury? Yeah, well, your prior injury.
That to be determined. But actually, my shoulder hurts more than my legs do.
Yeah, I
so
understand that.
We'll see. Anyway, two great events, and just to let you know about those going on, and thank you very much for letting us mention them, because I think you all will enjoy being a part of them. We have a lot to talk about, and a lot of letters from what we were discussing. John in the mailbag says, Congress is responsible for setting policy and enacting the laws that govern the country. In my opinion, all Congress has done recently is enrich themselves. It's their job to fix immigration, climate change, voting rights, gun control, etc. And we continue to wallow in indecision. Then we go to this letter. Feel free to jump in at any time, panel. Linda says, most people feel that we are being invaded when it comes to migration. I don't know. I don't get that feeling exactly.
I don't either.
Okay.
Well, there are people who always feel that they're being invaded if other people come from other countries. And so, you know, it's not a pleasant thing that we go through, but it's part of the deal.
They're not real Americans, you know.
I mean, that's how we got here, right?
Yeah.
Well, absolutely.
That's how most of us got here, but it doesn't seem to make a difference. And those who didn't get here that way are now even further marginalized.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting stuff, though, when you start to really trace it down. My father's family was in Russia. And then they went to England for 1 year, and my father spoke with an English accent for the rest of his life.
Hey, you know, you pick it up when you...
You know, I think the other thing here is that I think there's some truth to that. People believe that immigrants are coming. There's a criminalization of migrants and immigrants who come to the country, just flat out. And I think some of us understand that that's not true, but others, are... I don't want to say convinced, but they're swayed for sure. You know, that it's either a drug cartel or it's going to be, you know, some kind of criminal behavior once they're in the United States. They're taking our jobs. So I think that is a running rhetoric that ignores. And it also claims that America is just a white-founded nation.
Yeah,
that
is, right.
All right, let's go to this letter from Philip. How about Lisa? I heard a brief headline that some luxury hotels in New York City will be redeveloped into housing for people being bused here from southern borders. Can your panelists speak about this? There was a major article in the New York Times about this on Saturday. My two cents of this, of course, turn this over to Sarah, but I don't know if I'd actually call these luxury hotels, but go ahead.
No.
Yeah.
And the Adams administration had months and months and months of other input from stakeholders telling him what he should be doing, and this is a result of him not doing that. They originally had set up tent cities for these folks, and then they would bus them out there, and then people would arrive and be like, yeah, no, this isn't going to work for our family because we have
children and we have food.
Yeah, we don't want to live with other family, 20 other families that we don't know in a tent.
We don't know where to plug in the light in the tent.
That's
not
February.
In the middle of winter.
You don't know
who
you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, there are predators everywhere. Yeah. It doesn't matter if they're forever or not.
It's just about a fundamental humanity and what sort of welcome we provide. And so there are other municipalities who are currently in the stages of trying to plan what a responsible welcome is. When you hold yourself out to be a welcoming city, you should be able to back that up. And you should, by the way, also make sure that you're paying attention to the conversation around how to assist others who are similarly situated, homeless veterans, different groups. Like there are, it's time for governments to listen to the smart solutions for these deep problems. It's frustrating that it has to happen when immigration rises to the level of a crisis. And then all of a sudden we turn to social safety nets and how to better construct them. But sometimes that's what it takes. They're not luxury hotels. They're empty office buildings and hotels that haven't been in use. And they're trying to repurpose those because their first idea didn't work.
And immigration is an issue that's been kicked, the can that's been kicked down the road for decades.
Just like a bunch of other issues that insane. Our public education system is then forced to solve. Food security, right? All these things end up getting kicked down to state, local government levels. I'm telling you, county level and city level governments are about to have the biggest crises. They do. They currently have the biggest crises. They're coming up with the most innovative solutions, and they are begging the federal government to get on board.
Jennifer? I have a question. Yeah. So first, one of the, in multiple articles I read, one of the points that people were making was that this agreement between Canada and the United States for the northern border and the 15,000 migrants was going to help reduce the number coming across the southern border. How is that true?
Yeah, I had that exact same question.
It never, ever is. And it's because people believe that the people who are coming here know about our immigration system or know fundamentally that this is, in my experience representing folks for over 20 years, all the people know is they're running from something and trying to go to safety. So safety is often what most people know until our government tells them otherwise.
So is the to more important than the from? Mm.
No. And sometimes the to is responsible for the from. You know, the Reagan administration deliberately interfered in the politics of the Northern Triangle, which has fueled migration for decades. That it is so incredibly complex. There's no way a 13-year-old in Guatemala is like, oh, Justin Trudeau just did something that will make it favorable for me. And all that this, well, I shouldn't say, what this is a tweak of the Safe Third Country Agreement to eliminate irregular border crossings as an exception. So it's just saying that they can turn people back at Roxham Road and other irregular border crossings.
So that leads to my next question, fiction. Which is essentially that now our northern border in the United States, southern border of Canada, the whole, anywhere along the border line is being treated in a similar fashion to the official entry points, where anywhere now that you cross, you can be turned away.
Yeah. And it's not just a line, it's a zone, right?
Right.
So, like, you could be, like, 20 miles within the vicinity of the border and still be treated as though you're at the border. So that's how, like, Greyhound buses often that travel along the northern border are often targets of federal immigration enforcement because technically that's the border.
So they essentially removed the law as applying to only the official immigration.
It's more like they expanded the current law to cover the other, as opposed to removing anything.
So could you explain the idea of the targets here? What's happening? I don't get that.
Haitian migrants going through Roxham Road, which is an unofficial port of entry to Canada.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's not the explicit quote-unquote target. It's cracking down on illegal migration. That's always what they say. It's a short term. It's very extremely short sighted for, as it always is, for temporary influx, which is increasingly less temporary. I'll concede that point. But it's cyclical, and then we have just harsher and harsher penalties. And the idea of the criminalization of immigration. I mean, like President. The former president, who is about to be indicted, said on multiple occasions from the jump he started that narrative. It's not a surprise that that public opinion is turning against migrants.
Let's go to a couple more letters on this subject. Sarah, this is from Lynn, who says, Sarah wants all refugees to be able to enter the U.S. regardless of status. The arguments against this are considerable, from the financial due to climate change, like money needed for FEMA, and economic to finally raise the living standards of the populations here. We should fix the legal immigration quotas, absolutely. Why should critics be branded inhumane and reactionary for wanting legal conditions?
So there's so many things wrong with that. First of all, refugee is a legal definition. So it's defined in international law and codified in U.S. immigration law. So the point of the letter is really not is really sort of making itself. There aren't problems with legal ways to regulate the flow of migration patterns. What's happening is increasingly restrictionist laws that don't see the full picture, like the economic drivers, like the affordable cost of living, which, by the way, I mean, I don't quite understand that part of the letter, because study upon study upon study from various political opinions have shown that when you have refugees in particular, which again are a legally defined group of individuals, that when they move into a city, the rates of crime go down, the economic engines go up. So this letter sort of encapsulates the mythology that has been created around the idea of immigrants in this country.
Right.
So what do we do to counter that?
I've spent decades trying, and it's really getting frustrating. It's getting worse. I don't have the power to do it. We need people like Joe Biden and Justin Trudeau to say, you know what? This is a global issue, and we're going to take responsibility for it, and we're going to raise the caps, and we are going to incentivize states and localities to provide resettlement services. We are going to give money to refugee resettlement organizations instead of border patrol for drones that don't do anything.
And why isn't that going to happen?
Because you have this political opinion problem, because the Trump administration and Stephen Miller deliberately intervened in a campaign of misinformation in order to turn public opinion against migrants.
And the issue, yes, this is all true. It's so much easier to demonize, because it's quick, it's simple, they're bad. It's a lot more difficult to explain why they're good. And we tend to get stuck in our heads when we try to explain what's good, and don't do the simple and quick. Like, immigrants are good for our local economy. Immigrants create jobs and local business. Immigrants
enrich our culture, music.
Enrich our culture. It's three things. It's three things. You got to say no more than three things, but you have to do it in a way that's simple and for people to understand. And we have a tendency to get caught up in what's going on in our heads, while Trump and Stephen Miller, immigrants equals bad. Immigrants equals dangerous. Immigrants equal they're going to kill you. And
but
that's it.
You're going to have to incorporate in here some kind of racial elements.
Yeah.
Because many people, as you were saying in the beginning with those first three things, believe immigrants are good if they're coming from European countries,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
They're bad if they're coming from black and brown countries. Or, you know, that's part of the rhetoric that gets missed. So if that racial element is not included somehow and really faced head on,
yeah.
then we're going to continue to be in the same position.
Right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
All right. We just have about 2 minutes. I want to get to just we'll go to a few more letters, and then we'll come back with new topic and finish up our time together. This is from Philip, the only way that politicians might allow more immigration is if those immigrants are white European descent. That's just what you were saying a moment ago. We also have this letter, I believe, from Shoba, who says, welcoming undocumented would be would-be immigrants is laudable. However, what are the funds to resettle thousands of people? By the way, please know that people around the world who want to visit relatives in this country have a nearly two-year wait for a visa. We've got about a minute and a half.
It really depends. You know, the visa issue for people who are visiting is very different than the visa issue for people who want to reunite with their families. And I think that the reader might be conflating the two. It depends on the wait times for United States Citizenship and Immigration Service, which fluctuates. And the reader's correct, or the listener's correct, it does fluctuate also by, dependent on the country that you're coming from. In a lot of cases, it's very complicated. I was just reading an article about artificial intelligence being used to clear backlogs in migration, and it's just reproducing the same racial issues that we created in our laws to begin with. But the idea that you need money to resettle refugees is not incorrect, but we already have a refugee resettlement agency that predates this crisis that is underfunded. So allocation of resources. If there's a crisis, you allocate resources to the crisis. And then when the crisis subsides, new solutions emerge.
But it still comes down to the fact that we need the money, or that
we need money to do everything. That's a red herring. Like, you need money. You wake up, you need money.
Well, we have 20 seconds.
Yes. All right.
Let's talk about herrings. Red and of other colors.
Am I my blubber's kipper?
Yes, right. And there's matchist and cream, and I like the cream.
We'll discuss all of this after a short break. Sarah has to leave, but we'll talk about it still right after this. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And very nice to have you with us on this Monday morning. We do have Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, and Libby Post. Sarah Rogerson did have to leave. She was scheduled to leave. I just want you to think that she left during the the height of the conversation. She was scheduled to leave at 10:30, so she had a meeting. So, but thank you very much for her being here this morning. Let's go to other topics, and we'll have a few moments to talk about things going on. Well, Alan, let's talk about NPR.
Good idea.
Yes. NPR, National Public Radio, as you know, we are in an NPR member station, and they announced that they are cutting 10% of their staff, and they are also halting productions of 4 podcasts. They made this announcement late last week, and they're stopping production of Invisibilia, Louder Than a Riot, Rough Translation, and Everyone and Their Mom, to make up for a $30 million gap in the budget. The layoffs were widespread across different departments and included producers, hosts, audience researchers, and designers. NPR first announced the layoffs last month after eliminating open positions, restricting non-essential travel, and suspending internship programs, moves that it says saved only $14 million. Unfortunately, NPR has had to take painful but necessary steps to address a $30 million shortfall in revenues from corporate sponsorship, according to Isabel Lara, a spokeswoman for NPR. We've tried as much as possible to retain our industry-leading podcast portfolio, including all daily and weekly shows, and focus on key strategic priorities, daily habits, and serving new audiences. I wanted to bring this up for 2 reasons.
Mm-hmm.
The most important reason is Alan, I know you and me and the station have gotten a lot of letters of people wondering how this will affect us, and I will allow you to address that.
Well, it won't affect us really at all, because we do our job, and we understand that NPR is different from the radio station. This radio station does its thing, and I don't think that we find that there's really any problem in doing that. So this new news, I don't think, means a lot. At least it doesn't to me. You, Joe?
No, I agree with you. I think what's one important thing is that the main programs, the flagship programs of NPR, are not expected to be impacted in this. However, there are going to be some staff shifts, and there's going to be some changes within the work environment with NPR, which really has nothing to do with us. We run our own race, and
when they should behave themselves. NPR has always had, and I always get letters when I say this, but it's always had its arrogant side. I'm sorry, but, you know, they better understand that there are a lot of reasons that people get down on them.
You know, you look at this, and this is an oversimplification. I will admit this is an oversimplification, and I apologize for it being an oversimplification. But we do our show here. We do it 5 days a week. We do it 3 hours a day. And there's a core of about three or four of us who work on the show, not including the panel.
Right.
And an average NPR weekly show has about 40 to 50 people working on it.
It's unbelievable.
So there's a lot of now, could you say, oh, your show could use more people? Well, sure. But by the same token, not that many.
You don't have the room.
No. And it's just, it is remarkable. So I don't know, you know, there's a lot of, I'm sure there's a lot of duplication. I think the podcast thing is really interesting because a lot of these podcasts, one of them is relatively new that they just started and put some pretty good money into. And they're already canceling it, so they're not
knowing what they're doing.
Well, they're not knowing. Okay, I'll give you that. But they're not giving time to see how it's going to go. You know, they're just cutting bait mm-hmm. now, and this all comes at the risk. I say this with great worry saying it in front of Alan, but I'll say it anyway. And this comes as other radio stations in our region, like New England Public Media, announced that they're facing major cuts.
They're in trouble.
And programs are going away, and that is both a television and radio combo. But still, there are things that are leaving the airwaves as a result of these cuts. Also, and I think this is only fair to say that this is not just an NPR problem. The Washington Post, CNN, Vox, yeah. Bustle, mm-hmm. Gannett, they have all seen huge reductions in the number of people that they have working for them. But it is it's interesting to see that this is happening to NPR, which I don't know, Alan, you've been here longer, much longer than I have, but I don't remember seeing anything this quite so drastic, with except of the downturn in 2008, 2009, but I don't think it was quite to this extent.
Well, I do think that NPR has to watch what it's doing, that there's a certain arrogance that goes with being NPR and the way that they treat others, including stations, that needs to be assessed because in the end, if you misbehave that way, it is going to cost you.
So we discussed that, and but again, 10% of not only 10% of its staff, but halting production of these podcasts, which if you're following the logic originally of the podcast division within NPR was to try to bring in a younger audience to National Public Radio to ensure future funding for the station so that people who were younger and, dare I say, hipper than us in this room.
Yeah, you say.
that would help and allow the stations and NPR to make more money.
Have we ever had a cutback of that kind, staff reduction?
I'm going with a 30-year memory. I know we had one time, you know, in the downturn we had one time where we made some I think we had to eliminate a position or two, and there was like a very brief furlough period that lasted maybe 2 weeks.
Yeah, it was very short.
Very short, and actually. It was very short. And also what happened was that there was some realigning of people who were thinking about leaving, decided to leave. And the people that were let go were brought back and really nothing changed. So mm-hmm. it was and that's all I remember, Alan.
That has to do with our audience. I mean, you know, they really have been there for us and with us. And, you know, it really has been unthinkable that we would suffer massive cutbacks. It's just not happening, and it just hasn't happened.
And you see the go ahead.
Well, I mean, you guys are lucky because, you know, you have a loyal base of people who want to make sure that you stay on the air. There are newsrooms across the country and across New York that are ghost towns compared to what they used to be. And I'm working on a bill now that would help both station owners, NPR stations or public radio stations, as well as publishers. It's called the Local Journalism Sustainability Act, and it provides a 50% tax credit up to the first $50,000 of journalist salary for job creation. So the publisher, the station owner, the station management files for these refundable tax credits, and then they have to hire more people in their newsrooms. And so, it's really, you know, it's something that really could work. It came out of the Build Back Better bill.
Because so many newsrooms also have openings and they're unable to replace them. This is not for an opening. This would be for a new position.
This would be to fill whatever it is.
Okay.
Okay. To repopulate the newsroom. So gotcha. It's not about whether it's new or an old or an opening or whatever. It's about if we can get this passed and put into law and into the budget, it's about newsrooms being repopulated so that local government has oversight. And what I have found fascinating in all of this is that there was a recent study that showed taxes go up, people behave badly, they come to fisticuffs, blah, blah, blah. But banks are watching, and in terms of municipal lending, the interest rates are higher when you don't have local journalism as the watchdog for local municipalities and what's going on. And I find that part of it fascinating.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's really very interesting. And this is something that, you know, came out of the Build Back Better bill. And really could help. There's a great story out of Ogdensburg where they came to fisticuffs on the city council floor, a city council member and the mayor, and nobody knew it because there was no newspaper to cover.
Right, nobody there. Alan, this is a quick question from Natalie, who says, Alan, what do you mean by misbehave?
Yes, Alan, what do you mean by misbehave?
Hey, Alan, what do you mean when you said misbehave? I don't know. Bad decisions are made by everybody, and bad decisions are quite often made by radio stations, by newspapers. We've seen it again and again, and we have to be very cognizant of the fact that there are human beings running those enterprises.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's end there on this Monday. And I thank you all for being with us. A great pleasure to have you here. Alan, thank you very much.
And thanks for your leadership, Joe.
Thank you. Right back to you. We go many thanks to Jennifer Burns, who has a really cool event happening tomorrow, highlighting Black women engagement in our democracy and society. Tuesday, March 28th. From 5:30 to 7:30 at the Campus Center Ballroom and the Uptown campus of SUNY Albany. And congratulations. Have a great event.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Great to have you here. Libby?
Yeah?
We'll talk to you.
Yeah, I'm sure.
All right. Okay. Excellent. Thank you very much. We'll be back right after this.